Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Before we get into our main topic for today, three things. First, the Nobel Prize for Literature was announced this morning, and it goes to Alice Munro, the great Canadian short story writer who for decades has crafted very memorable art about the lives of ordinary people in small-town Ontario. She has a great eye for observing human dynamics and a great ear for creating fine writing. So congratulations to Alice Munro. Second, a great teacher of mindfulness meditation, or Vipassana, died on September 29th in Mumbai. His name was Mr. S.N. Goenka. The LA Times website yesterday had an article from Myanmar, where he was born and where his ashes have been returned to with much ado to be scattered in three sites, including the Irrawaddy River. Mr. Goenka often said that he taught not any sectarian Buddhism, but rather the art of living. I remember a wonderful comment from Joanna Macy, who was from a family of ministers and then later in life studied Buddhism, and she said, "Christianity taught me to love. Buddhism taught me how." So the art of living and this technique of mindful awareness is now, as you may have encountered, taught widely in medical settings for the reduction of stress and in psychotherapy. And a very large number of people who spread the technique of mindfulness, Mr. Goenka was the source. If not their teacher directly, he was probably their teacher's teacher. He has, in his lifetime, he established 150 meditation centers around the world and didn't own any of them. Rather, each is owned by a local nonprofit trust composed of meditators. And he taught the insight or mindfulness meditation courses thousands of times since 1970 and never took a dime for any of them, nor do any of his assistant teachers receive pay. Instead, he insisted that the teachings must be given freely. The courses and the meditation centers were funded solely through donations made by meditators after they had taken at least one course and learned the practice, and therefore wanted to enable others to be able to come and learn the practice of mindfulness. So if you're interested in this inspiring life, there's a wiki page about him, and I'm told a Facebook page. His last name is spelled G-O-E-N-K-A. Amazon has several books compiled from his talks, including one called The Art of Living. And there's also a website if you'd like to find one of the mindfulness courses, www.dhamma.org. Be happy, be happy. Third thing here, a few reflections on the extremely damaging constitutional crisis our country has found itself in. One aspect I haven't seen mentioned much is that even if the crisis were ended in the next 5 minutes, with a no-strings passing of the continuing resolution, that is to agree to pay our government's debts for spending that has already been appropriated, and even if there were a resolution to raise the debt ceiling as usual, even if that were done, the Tea Party congressman would not be able to eradicate the lasting and perhaps permanent damage they have done all around the world to us in capital cities with regard to other governments and individuals having confidence in buying U.S. Treasury bonds because our government was always thought to be secure and reliable. Not anymore. We need for people to buy our U.S. Treasury bonds and float this boat. But the extremist takeover of the Republican Party has twice now taken our government to the brink of financial disaster, and bondholders worldwide now see that these people will most likely do it again and again. why can't the Democrats get this across to the public? 130 Republican congressmen and women were in the House of Representatives when President Bush requested the routine raising of the debt ceiling, and they all did it, sure, as the House always has. We pay our bills for past allocations. And this has never been a place in the process where either party fought out future budget issues. But the Tea Party lunatics in Congress are so reckless and intractable, and the situation is so dangerous, that yesterday, giant Fidelity Investments dumped all their short-term U.S. Treasury bonds from their mutual funds. Now, the fact that the Tea Party congressman boasted for months ahead of time that they were going to administer some shock therapy to our country, and they publicly declared that they are really looking forward to shutting down the U.S. government this fall just because they can. That made it clear that these are people who do not give a fig how much damage they do to the United States in the short term and in the long term. These are the sorts of callous, irresponsible, ill-informed people who have frequently made it into state assemblies. Molly Ivins used to write about them in the Texas legislature to great effect. But they didn't get into the United States House of Representatives. So how did so many of them get to Congress? It's because the majority of congressional electoral districts have been gerrymandered to be so-called safe districts. Because the Tea Party congressmen are from districts designed to include far more Republicans than Democrats, they never have to face any real opposition from Democrats. They need only mount an alarmist campaign to scare people and lure Republican voters away from any moderate Republican. This is not a democratic electoral system in the way the framers of the Constitution envisioned it. The only solution is for the U.S. Justice Department to go after the anti-democratic gerrymandering of congressional electoral districts, as they did in the past, when gerrymandering was used to split large African-American or Latino population centers so that little parts of it became only a small piece in a largely white electoral district. The anti-democratic gerrymandering must be challenged on legal grounds and corrected. The current thuggery in Congress has shown that correcting gerrymandering is as crucial an issue as campaign finance reform. And you know what a mad dog I am about campaign finance reform. All votes are corrupted. We can't get anywhere of what the American people really need as long as every vote is bought and corrupt. So if we can't repair our democratic process, well, we've seen in these past few days that the Tea Party will not stop short of the ruination of our country. And why can't the Democrats get that across? The Tea Party has been able to convince many Americans that many Americans, a shocking number, that they are merely being good patriots instead of profoundly destructive extortionists. So call me a grumpy old green, but really, why are the Democrats so ineffectual? You can just imagine if the situation were reversed, although the Democrats never employed such obstructionist thuggery when a Republican president was in office. But just suppose the situation were reversed. First of all, as we know, the GOP would be working with Frank Luntz and other specialists in choosing convincing language, and then they would coordinate at all levels so people across the country would hear from different sources the GOP's naming of the assault on constitutional duties that the imposed shutdown and threat of default really involves. And they would make clear that the obstructionists are the ones who started this and are continuing it in spite of the clear damage to our country. Oh, yes, the Republican machine would make that clear in so many ways to the public. But the Democrats, in this very real crisis, I've seen some of the ads they've begun showing in recent days against various Tea Party congressmen who will be up for re-election. These ads are frivolous and cartoon-like, and it's just extremely disappointing. The news this morning from the crisis was no better, but you can read about that yourself if interested. Okay, today we are going to talk about women. Wait, what's that? Some very recent studies found that the life expectancy rates for many American women have declined in the past two decades, and that a sizable number of them are expected to live shorter lives than did their mothers. In one study published in the journal Health Affairs, researchers at the University of Wisconsin discovered declining life expectancy for women in about 43% of the counties across the nation. That's where these health records are kept. So they look at all the county records in our country, and almost half are showing this shocking finding. In fact, researchers were so shocked, the head of the project had them run all the numbers again. Just start at the beginning, do it all over. This can't be possible. But they did do it, and the same thing came up, which was the finding that women aged 75 and younger are dying at higher rates than in previous years. And many of these women live in rural areas in the South and the West. Life expectancy rates for men, however, have stayed about the same. The lead investigator of the study commented, "It's unprecedented in American history to see a drop of life expectancy of such magnitude over such a short time period." And then a different study found pretty much the same thing. Life expectancy for women had stagnated or declined in 45% of U.S. counties between 1985 and 2010. And in both cases, the researchers have been unable to fully explain these findings, although higher rates of obesity, smoking, and dropping out of high school in rural areas are being looked at. So if you want to know more, there's an article about this on the website for The Atlantic. Dated October 7th. Seeing that reminded me of a study I cited in Relational Reality about women's mental health, specifically the incidence of depression. A study of women begun by the National Institute of Mental Health in the 1970s found that although prosperity increased in the decades since World War I, rates of depression increased as well, and this is a study of women. The National Institute for Mental Health research team had expected depression to be linked with periods of hardship, particularly the Great Depression, the 1930s, or World War II, but they found the opposite. Among women born around World War I, only 1% had experienced depression. For those born around World War II, the percentage was 3%. Among those born around the time of the Korean War, it was 7%. For those born during the Vietnam War era, the rate was 10%. And for those born in the post-Vietnam War era, between 12 and 15% had had a serious episode of depression by the time they had completed high school. So I conclude, as the relational web of community ties and extended family connections diminished over the course of the 20th century, so too did the women's sense of well-being. We are all profoundly relational beings, and we need that interconnection, as I've talked about many times. With all these new studies I call relational physiology, how the quality of your relationships affects your physical being. So one last orienting statistic. A World Bank report has estimated that more women between the ages of 15 and 44 die in rapes and domestic violence than from cancer, car accidents, war, and malaria combined. And this was posted on the UN website, UN Statement Against Violence Against Women, March 18th, 2013. So all these facts about women's lives are situated in a larger context, and my guest today has written several books that insightfully analyze that larger context. Elizabeth Dodson Gray is a feminist theologian, environmentalist, futurist, and author. She holds a graduate degree in theology from Yale Divinity School. For 32 years, she was coordinator of the Theological Opportunities Program, a lecture series begun at Harvard Divinity School in 1973. She's taught at MIT, Williams College, Antioch, New England, Graduate School, and others. She was the only woman on the editorial board of Macmillan's Encyclopedia of the Future. Whose future? For 25 years, she lectured in campus and religious settings throughout the United States and Canada, sometimes in Europe, about ecology, religion, and ecofeminism. She's the co-author with her husband, I will say, the very excellent David Dotson Gray, and another MIT colleague of Growth and Its Implications for the Future, a book originally prepared as staff work for congressional hearings in the mid-1970s. She's also the author of Green Paradise Lost, 1979, which had a pioneering role in the development of ecofeminism. Her second book, Patriarchy as a Conceptual Trap, 1982, is footnoted with 59 cartoons and is about how a male-dominated world cannot see its own assumptions, blindness, and limitations. She also edited Sacred Dimensions of Women's Experience, 1988, a groundbreaking book of women's spirituality that emerged out of the Fall 1984 lecture series program she directed. And then her next book was Sunday School Manifesto, 1994, a call for the gender reformation of Christianity. Her memoir, Walking My Yellow Brick Road, was published just a few months ago. So we'll hear about that later in the program. She writes as a feminist theologian, weaving her environmental and futurist concerns together with insights of Christian ethics and theology, using her own feminist adaptation of insights drawn from the sociology of knowledge. In 1988, the National Film Board of Canada's Studio D released an 18-minute film for television, Adam's World, about her thought and work. And in the year 2000, the dean of the Yale Divinity School and its Board of Alumnal Affairs presented her with an award for distinction for lay ministry within the church. Elizabeth Dotson Gray, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Charlene. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I just want to tell people that I attempted to have you on as if they were listening on September 12th, and there was a problem with your phone line then, but please, if you want to get the full introduction, which I'm not going to repeat in case people are listening both times, do listen to that. I told a wonderful story about her when she was a respondent at the annual lecture of the E.F. Schumacher Society of America, which is really captures a lot and is a tremendous role model episode there. So I was delighted to see that at the glorious age of 84, you've written a memoir of your fruitful and influential life, Walking My Yellow Brick Road, and I'm going to come back to that later on, but I'd like to begin by asking you about one of your earlier books.
Okay.
And the 1970s was, of course, the big decade in which so many legal struggles were waged and won, so that women were no longer shut out of numerous areas of American culture and society.
Right, right.
But then the generation of young women who came of age during the 1980s, 1990s, and the aught years sort of surprised us all by largely opting out of any identification with feminism rather than building on it to finish all that still remained to be addressed. And, of course, there is third-wave feminism, fourth-wave feminism, and beyond. But these are much smaller phenomena than one might expect, given the situation. So I've been glad to hear lately that many young women are newly becoming activists about women's rights. And, for example, just a few days in the mail, I got a routine mailing from the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, which is the national organization of Buddhist meditators who are involved with social change issues. And in its heyday, this was run by luminaries like Gary Snyder, Joanna Macy, Robert Aitken, lots of other inspiring people. And then it sort of, it not went dormant, but went to a lesser level. And then I saw that these two young women had taken over running it a year or two ago. And I thought, well, okay, that's interesting. So today, or a few days ago in the mail, I got this postcard, and it has some lovely photograph of the little bronze Buddha statue in meditation next to this plant on a windowsill. And then there's lettering superimposed next to it, and it says, "Peace means ending patriarchy."
Wow.
that's a different tack for that organization.
Right.
And I've also
right.
been reading that a lot of young women are newly activated around the issue of physical violations of women, such as domestic violence and rapes.
Right,
and
right.
the question of why are so many universities covering up the true number of rapes on their campuses instead
right.
of reporting them to police as the law requires? Well,
right.
I mean, we know the why. They want to be able to sell their setting as safe and not tell the truth, but that's illegal. So I've also noticed, sadly, that in a number of different issue areas, these admirable young feminists end up sort of reinventing the wheel in terms of putting great effort into making the links and figuring it all out and, you know, publishing that as something that's crucial in order to go forward, which it is. But that's why I've invited you onto the program. In the interest of progress and building on what's been done, I would like very much for you to tell us about the analyses you came to, still so very useful, and in particular, would you start with a concept you call Adam's World? And that was from your book, Patriarchy as a Conceptual Trap.
Right, I would love to. I think I got to the concept of Adam's World by realizing at one point, I don't know, in my 30s, as I look back upon my life, that I had had a very excellent education at a liberal arts college, Smith College, and almost every book I read was written by a man. And was about male life experience. And then I went on to graduate school, and I had 3 years of post-college training in theology, and you know what? Every book I read was written by a man, except there was a little notice given to Mary Baker Eddy, but she was considered inferior, and we never even asked to read her, okay? Mm. And I suddenly realized that I had been educated in a male world. Not in the world that included both genders, but in a male world. So I came up with this idea of Adam's world. You know, in the Bible, in Genesis, Adam is portrayed as naming the animals, which is really interesting because my concept of Adam's world, my husband, wonderful husband, made a cartoon for my book, Patriarchy as a Conceptual Trap, which has 59 cartoons from other places, but he did his own cartoon. And it shows a bubble, a circle, with a stick figure of a male inside it, and the name, a place, Adam's World, a little name, a place sign in it. And Adam is saying, this is the way the world is. I've named everything from my point of view. And I suddenly realized that feminism was not about just about, you know, what women could do in terms of making money as much as men and stuff, and even about the horrors of domestic abuse and stuff. It was the fact that we are inside this bubble that is not our bubble.
Right.
It is from the male point of view. And if you doubt this, think of the way male sexual experience has even crept into our language. Do you remember phrases like the thrust of his argument, the penetrating analysis?
Seminar argument,
exactly. They are not even ashamed to put these phrases in that are so clearly from male genital experience. And it's a parable of how we live inside everything named from the point of view of the male. And
examples of this so people can really grasp what you're talking about, because it is completely invisible in our socialization. So hold on a sec, because we have to pause here for the break.
Okay, all right.
This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Elizabeth Dodson Gray. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Elizabeth Dodson Gray. Her website, at which all of her books are available, by the way, is elizabethdodsongray.com. So that's ElizabethDodsonGray.com. So let's go back to talking about your book, Patriarchy as a Conceptual Trap. And in it, you define a conceptual trap as the thought world of the mind. Once you're socialized in it from birth on, it's a way of thinking in which it's like a room, and you're inside of it. Once inside of it, you can't imagine any world outside of it.
Yes,
and
exactly.
You define patriarchy as a culture that is slanted so that men are valued a lot and women are valued less.
Yes.
Or in which men's prestige is up and women's prestige is down. And I would say, along with the French feminist philosopher Luce Ateguedai, that, we could have this dynamic culture of this conversation between the feminist or the male and the female ways of experiencing life,
yes,
as she points out. But instead of that dynamic conversation, we can't have that because half is missing. The whole culture, the language, the knowledge systems, the educational system, the assumptions in the public sphere, everything has evolved to be comfortable to the male psyche. And
that's
right. As you say, completely invisible to them. They just feel this is the natural way an advanced human thinks. And they can't see that that's tied to the male way of experiencing the world and the male way of experiencing the world being raised in a patriarchal culture.
Right.
So maybe you could give some examples for the listeners here of how we live in Adam's world.
Okay. Well, I think it's interesting that Margaret Mead, when she did her anthropological investigation around the world, she made an interesting discovery. She said it didn't matter what was done by a particular tribe, it only matters who did it. If weaving was done by men in a particular tribe, it was high prestige. If 20 miles away, weaving was done by women, it was low prestige. And she found this all over the world. Now, that's very interesting. And I have in my book a cartoon of the Stone Age, and it shows two Stone Age gentlemen passing one another, and walking with one another, and they are passing a woman who is taking a block of stone and hammering away at it, and she is making a square into a wheel, a circle. And the man says to the other man, "Women do the craziest things." Which shows you that if indeed a man was doing that, it would be thought profoundly revolutionary, discovering the wheel.
Uh-huh.
But the woman doing it, it is denigrated. Think also of the most magical thing that human beings do. It is when the sperm joins with the egg, or the egg joins with the sperm, to produce a fetus which is grown inside a female body all over the world and given birth to by female bodies. It is magical, a new human being comes into the world. It's a miracle. But is there a single patriarchal religion on the planet, Christianity, Buddhism, Taoism, Judaism, any of them, Islam, not one of them labels giving birth a sacred act.
Mm-hmm.
Because why? Men don't do it.
Yeah.
Men don't do it.
Yeah.
Women do it. And they are not going to put it out as a sacred thing to make women feel better because they must feel good. And that's the name of patriarchy, I'm afraid.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And just I think one of the main things I'd like the listeners to understand is that it's almost as if you had a lot of male co-authors in this book, Patriarchy as a Conceptual Trap, because you used all those cartoons from The New Yorker, which are almost all by male cartoonists.
That's right.
Really admitting what you were saying. And so it was almost as a group voice, cutting across
gender lines. I did that on purpose because I was sure that as I made feminist statements and they read them, people read them, particularly men read them, they would say, "Oh, this is a woman saying this." And I wanted them to turn the page and find there a cartoon from The New Yorker done by a male artist saying, "Look, this is exactly what is true. That's exactly what she said."
Uh-huh.
And And my daughter was in college when I wrote the book, and she said, "Mom, you have footnoted this with cartoons." And I said, "Yes, I have." And the greatest compliment was ever paid to me, one of the greatest, was a young woman who came up to me when I was lecturing once and said, I gave a copy of Patriarchy as a Conceptual Trap to my husband, who did not understand feminism. And he read it and he said, "Now I am a feminist." And I said, "That's the nicest thing you could possibly say to me, because we must understand that the greatest problem that women have in this culture is that they live inside Adam's world. Everything thought from the male point of view. And how do they navigate this culture, given that that is true?"
Yeah, yeah. And it seems that in recent decades, the culture has just drifted more toward the adolescent male druthers.
I mean, yes,
the fact that, you know, going steady, having a relationship, that dropped away, and there was just hooking up, you know.
That's right. Yep,
quick
exactly.
sex. Well, who likes that? You know, it's the adolescent males, and the girls, you know, felt they had to go along with it to have a boyfriend. So, there are a lot of ways which it seems to be, as I say, the culture drifting in that direction.
Yes, yes,
and,
yes.
As you say, that man who had that response, that's the same response I remember the feminist writer Letty Cotton Pogrebin said in the beginning. Her husband was, you know, trying to figure out what the fuss was, what she was so excited about. He was an attorney in New York. And so he listened to some of it, and then he said, "Oh, I recognized it as justice issues. These are justice issues, okay?"
These are justice issues.
So he was on board.
Absolutely.
But, you know, the idea that the culture also flattens out, either flattens out or intensifies in a false way the differences between male and female. They either say they're so extreme, women can't do this or that, but they also pretend that there's only one human way, and that's the male way. When, in fact, as I mentioned in the book Relational Reality, these tests since the early 50s of perception always cross-culturally around the world, they've been replicated so many times, they show that the girls and women have a gestalt perception of what's going on. They see all the dynamic interconnectedness, and the males tend to just drop the background away and focus on the foreground figure. Now, one's not right or wrong. We need both of them.
Yes,
but, you know, if the culture's designed to only elevate and honor the one, then we're really operating in a very much reduced and diminished version of what we could have.
That's right. Someone has said that we're trying to drive down the highway with only one headlight on, and the other headlight that is available to us we're not using. And as far as the human species, we are using the ability of the human male to see things from his point of view that are not available to us. But equally, he is undernourished by the fact that he is not exposed to what the female of the species sees from her point of view of her life experience. And it is a sad, you know, a problem, because it's only half of the reality that we could be seeing.
Right. And in recent years, it's become clear that it's way more than half, and I'm talking about these new discoveries coming out of physiology about the dynamic interrelatedness of things, the way the whole field, for instance, of microbiology has moved off the mechanistic model onto the relational model of understanding how bacteria works.
That's
And you've probably read about this. They're saying, "Oh, my gosh, we were wrong for 300 years. So with all of modern medicine, we thought to get rid of a bad bacteria in you, we had to go in and carpet bomb your whole system with poison. But now we see that bad bacteria will be suppressed if we just implant a good bacteria, because they work in dynamic interrelationships.
Yes, yes,
so this is a huge shift coming out of male-dominated science, and I really have great hopes that this is going to help nudge the culture into honoring and cultivating relational perception, relational analysis.
Yes. I agree. I totally agree.
Well, now I want to move on to another interesting concept in your Sunday School Manifesto, this gender reformation of Christianity. How's that working out?
Well, I think it's coming along, as a matter of fact, because there are just many, many, many more women ministers, women rabbis,
mm-hmm.
and I think as women preach from the pulpit, and that's not even considered remarkable anymore, that you get a lot more of what the female of the species is thinking about either Christianity, Judaism, I don't know what's happening in Islam. But so I think that is coming to the fore a lot. I think in individual churches, women take leadership now that they didn't take before. They're active on the board that used to be, the governing boards of the churches and synagogues used to be all male. That's certainly mm-hmm. not true anymore. So mm-hmm. I think there's a lot, just the way within lawyers and doctors, you now have so many more women doctors, so many more women lawyers, you are getting a lot more expression. The only problem is if when you are elected to the elite club of the ministerial role, if you maintain your way of communicating from your inside, your sense of your female experience, but it's a great temptation to become like the guys. And when that happens, then this kind of richness of the two sexes and seeing what they both each perceive, you know, doesn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what's so important, as I say about Itagarai's idea that, you know, don't cover up your true nature. You're bringing forth this other half of humanity that
yes.
has to be at the table
yes,
if
absolutely.
We want to reach any really realistic analyses and solutions to things. So, you know, honor your own relational way of seeing things.
Yes,
well,
I'd like to.
I think when you say Islam, by the way, one of the things that's happening in Islam is that so many women in different Islamic cultures, once they were allowed to become educated, you know, have revealed the fact that the Quran does not say 90% of the female suppressing things that are done in cultures. Those have all been put in over the centuries by the men who were in charge of the religious institution. So, you know, they're really making the case for rolling this back. This isn't in the Quran. Why do we do this in this country to women?
That's right. Yeah. And I heard that from a Islam feminist scholar, 20 years ago, lecturing in my lecture. You know, and she said, you know, these things are not in the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
They are a product of the culture, a male-dominated culture that has existed around Islam, but they're not in the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really important, really important. Also, if you examine what happens in the New Testament, Jesus did not say anything denigrating about women. Instead, he was an incredible proponent of women. He talked to women in theological terms, which just wasn't done in his age.
Mm-hmm.
He spoke to women. You weren't supposed to speak to women very much, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised a Southern Baptist, and I was raised in the Bible, and I didn't understand for years until I was like, you know, my mid-20s, how Jesus broke the rules of how men related to women in his culture, and he broke it in ways that were very respectful of women.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in my book, you know, my
mm-hmm.
book, because I contrast the way the Christianity over centuries was denigrating to women, to women's bodies, to women's ideas and everything, and how if you contrast that with what happened in as recorded, what Jesus did in the New Testament, it is absolutely like night and day, because
mm-hmm.
women Jesus respected women. He talked to women about theological realities, you know, the
mm-hmm.
woman at the well and stuff. And
right.
and that's, it's just amazing. Difference.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well, let's move into talking about Walking My Yellow Brick Road, which is your memoir recently published. And I would like to just start by reading this front page one, actually, where you explain this orientation. Maybe you can say more about this. I felt like Dorothy in Frank Baum's fantasy about the Wizard of Oz. I wanted to get back to my equivalent of Dorothy's Kansas, back to where I was whole and focused and myself again. But unlike Dorothy, my yellow brick road has never just stretched out before me. Each yellow brick gleaming in the sunlight, oh no, my yellow brick road was and still is very elusive. It appears in front of me only at what seems to be one brick at a time. And I'm amazed that somehow, in some way, my own crazy, unorthodox, often elusive, but ever beckoning onward yellow brick road has given me some power to change the world. So, looking back on your life, I mean, what kind of surprised you in this process of writing about it?
Well, I'll tell you something that I really was made aware of. As I look back upon my child rearing, my first words in my book are, I was a very beloved child. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I was very carefully nurtured and loved and respected. I had a brother 6 years older than I, and he was quite bright. But I was never given the feeling that he was more important than I. Mm-hmm. My parents waited 6 years and couldn't get pregnant between him and me and were so thrilled when I was born, but thrilled that I was a girl. And so I felt as though, as I look back on my life, that so much of the way I was able to be confident in myself and make the contribution to the world that I knew that I could make as I started growing up was because I was loved and respected as a child. And I have just a huge... I don't even know how to describe it, a huge sense of how much we need to love and respect our children, both male and female, but particularly girls, so that they can trust who they are
mm-hmm.
and trust who they can become in the world,
mm-hmm.
be as big as they can be in the loving and interesting things that they think they can do. I knew somehow that I was thinking things that nobody else thought before I even wrote my book. I knew that was true. And I think it had a lot to do with how I was reared, to respect myself.
Yeah, I think maybe, you know, as you say, you went into the 50s wife and mother role. You had this advanced degree, but you basically played the role of wife of the minister. And then it must have been that foundational sense that helped you in midlife sort of expand, right?
Well, no, it helped me. I had a hard time when I was rearing my children. They
mm-hmm.
didn't know it. I was very fortunate that they didn't know that I was sad because I was not doing ministry. That's what I wanted to do. I was associate to the Baptist minister in Harvard Square for 3 years before I was married. But you're right. I did the traditional female thing. I supported my husband as a clergy wife. I had children, and I raised the children. And they were about 16, 15, 18 when I began writing my books, which my good husband edited and published for me. But in all that time, I knew that I saw things that other people didn't see. I could articulate things that they couldn't articulate, that I could glimpse visions of, I don't know, things that had not ever been thought before.
Uh-huh.
And so this my memoir is a story about that. And also it's a typical story of a woman who went through breast cancer. I had 5 breast cancer surgeries in 3.5 years.
Right.
And I had mystical experiences all scattered through my life, beginning with a mystical experience at age 3, which begins my story, and going through mystical experiences, 3 of them, while I was going through my cancer surgeries. And it's a story of just how that was sort of sprinkled in through the rest of a very typical woman's life, but that in itself, that those mystical experiences were not typical at all. It was my experience.
Okay, well, the name of the book is Walking My Yellow Brick Road, available from the website elizabethdodsongray.com, and we're out of time now, but I want to thank you so much, Elizabeth Dodson Gray, for coming on the program.
Thank you, Charlene. I'm grateful for the opportunity because you have been a great friend through the years. I've admired your writing and your work, and it's nice to be together on your show.
Oh, thank you. Okay, let's move over to the Arts Corner and see what we have. Our poem today is by the late Adrienne Rich, whose poetry was awarded the National Book Award and the Bollingen Prize. It's from her collection entitled The Dream of a Common Language. And the poem is entitled Power. Living in the earth deposits of our history. Today, a backhoe divulged out of a crumbling flank of earth, one bottle, amber, perfect, 100-year-old, cure for fever or melancholy, a tonic for living on this earth in the winters of this climate. Today, I was reading about Marie Curie. She must have known she suffered from radiation sickness. her body bombarded for years by the elements she had purified. It seems she denied to the end the source of the cataracts on her eyes, the cracked and separating skin of her finger ends, till she could no longer hold a test tube or a pencil. She died a famous woman, denying her wounds, denying that her wounds came from the same source as her power. Our song this week, well, what better way to round off a program about feminism than with a song about love? This is a song by Annie Lennox. And come to think of it, there is a feminist tie-in here. I happened to read an article recently in which a music critic said that he and his colleagues were surprised when Annie Lennox's very impressive solo albums came out, because they had assumed that when she was paired with Dave Stewart and the Eurythmics, all that great music, of course, must have been created by the male partner. But zut alors! It's now clear that Annie Lennox herself has a lot of talent as a composer, and always did. Gee, who'd have thunked it? Really, guys, when is this going to end? Well, this song is from her CD, Diva, which was named the best album of the year in Britain in 1992. The song is entitled Money Can't Buy It, written and performed by Annie Lennox. Here it is. with Money Can't Buy It. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here with her guest. I'll be back 2 weeks from today with my guest, Barbara Shaw, talking about new developments in the area of children's mental health. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spratnak with All Together Now.